It's because, like, if I have a business that exists in this culture, the culture has to
exist. Yeah, for you
right?
to have
I can't,
a business
I can't be
yeah.
the best streetwear brand, one of one. Like, yeah. You're ranked the number one of one streetwear brands. Like, that's yeah. like, it only works if you're ranked like one of 100. So I need 99 other kids to come into the game so that I can stomp on them. Right? like, come in so that we can battle. And then, like,
that's
but I
great.
Need that. Yeah. So,
well, and
really
they keep pushing
that.
You too.
Right? Yeah. And they push me to be better.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hello, and welcome to Overshare, a podcast where we have honest conversations with creative people we admire about the struggles that often come along with being a creative professional. In a world of carefully curated portfolio sites and Instagram feeds, we try to get past those highlights and discuss the tough stuff we don't talk about in public often enough. In this episode, you will learn what it takes to stay relevant over the course of your career and that your only job in life is to just stay alive. I'm your host, Justin Genak, and I'm also the co-founder of Working Not Working, a curated community that connects companies with the universe's most respected, most awarded, and hardest working creatives in advertising, design, production, and tech. We really appreciate everyone who has supported us so far, so if you've enjoyed Overshare and have gotten anything out of it, please take a minute to rate and review us. It goes a long way in helping other people discover the podcast. You can also subscribe to get new episodes when they're released. And if you're really into Overshare, please send us a note on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Overshare Talks. We would love to hear from you. So this is the last episode of season two. I've got to admit, I'm really proud of us. It took us over a year and a half to get the 10 episodes of season one out, and we've been able to deliver a new episode every 2 weeks for 13 episodes like a real professional podcast. It definitely would not have been possible without the generosity of the team at Second Child. Frances, Wani, Marty, Jesse, and Scott, they were always accommodating with the 9 episodes we recorded there in their studio. Also, thanks to Lucky Jacks and Camp David in New York and the Tramperee in London for hosting events for us this season. Thanks to the Working Not Working team who made those live events happen. Megan Campbell, Amanda Wilkes, Joe Visconti, and Gabby D'Amato. And I've got to double down on the thanks to Gabby, who's a champ and edited all of these episodes on top of her regular design workload here at Working Not Working. And also thanks to Mackenzie Weber, who runs digital media at Working Not Working and spreads the word on all of the Overshare social channels. I want to give a huge thanks to everyone who supported this fledgling podcast. I know we have analytics to tell me when people listen, but it's really easy to feel like you're doing this in a vacuum. So it's really meant a lot when people have messaged me throughout the season or come up to me at an event and told me you've liked it. And I also really want to thank everyone who has asked a question at the end of these live events. The sincerity and vulnerability of those questions inspired me and made me realize there's a need for these types of discussions and for spaces to have them. So this summer, we launched Talking Not Talking, a support group for creatives. Once a month, we get together after work and talk about whatever we're struggling with. We've already done a few in New York and have just started them up in LA and San Francisco as well. So if you're creative and want to come check them out, sign up for Working Not Working and you'll get the invites. Okay, so for the season finale, we went big. This is my interview with one of the founding fathers of streetwear, Jeff Staple, recorded in front of a live audience at Lucky Jack's in the Lower East Side. For those of you who don't know, Jeff is a legend. He's the founder and creative director of Staple Design and ReedSpace. His 2005 collaboration with Nike led to riots outside of ReedSpace as people fought to get their hands on the limited Nike SB Dunk Pigeon. Many people credit that moment and that shoe as the shoe that catapulted sneaker culture to the masses. Jeff is also the host of the podcast Business of Hype on Hype Beach Radio. Put a link to it in the show notes, so check it out. He's spoken and collaborated with anyone and everyone you'd ever want to speak to or collaborate with. He's also one of the nicest guys in the game and the unofficial mayor of the Lower East Side ever since he opened his store ReedSpace in 2001. He's now the creative director of TGS Holdings, whose shop Extra Butter is only a few doors down on Orchard Street. This episode has so much oversharing in it, from Jeff's somewhat questionable and illicit use of rollerblades to get accepted to Parsons, to his two very near-death experiences. He shares what he was thinking and regretting in the moments he started digging his own grave while stranded on the side of a mountain. So from start to finish, this interview was insightful and entertaining. I could keep talking about how great it is, but I'll just let you get to it. Please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Staple.
I don't think I've
really
ever done.
I
don't think I've ever done such an intimate, like, people so close.
It's almost like we're sitting on their laps.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
I might end up on a lap tonight if all goes well.
That sounded great. First of all, how are you?
I'm hanging in there.
You're hanging in there.
Yeah.
It's a busy week.
It's a busy time. Just lots of stuff going on. Lots of travel. You know, I think everyone's trying to get ready and get stuff in before the, you know, the holidays. So this
it's
October,
crazy
November.
We're even thinking of the holidays right now.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. It's crazy that I'm writing 11 on, like, you know, already. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it's 70 degrees out. but congrats, you had a big launch this week with Puma.
Yep.
You're wearing them?
I'm wearing a pair now. Yeah, we just dropped a Puma yesterday. exclusively in the Lower East Side first. Yeah. It's going to be global next week. Not that this is a plug, but...
No, it should be. They're pretty amazing. They got some fur on the back, a little fuzziness.
Yeah. We had to skin a lot of puma cats for this one.
Yep. No, he's just joking. I just like that. I met Jeff because of ReadSpace. I was trying to get my New York City garbage cubes into ReadSpace, and you were kind enough to have...
Does everyone know what the New York City garbage cube is, first of all? Let me tell the story.
Okay, go ahead.
So he walks into our store, which carries all different stuff. Like, you know, it's a lifestyle sort of store. It carries, like, art, fashion, sneakers, you know, mixtapes, all that stuff. He comes in, and he's like, hey, I made this creation. It was a clear plexiglass cube about the size of a Rubik's Cube filled with New York City garbage. Just trash, literally trash. And then in really nice, perfectly kerned Helvetica Noé bold, it said garbage, New York City, right? And okay, I'm going to try to remember the price. I think it was like $50. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, what's the price? Like $50. I was like, all right, I'm in.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And the thing is, like, if you guys hadn't been to ReadSpace, is like, if you got into ReadSpace, like, you'd made it. And so I had friends would go in there and like, holy fuck, man, you're in ReadSpace? And I was like, yes, I made it.
Yeah.
So it was, it was good. It was.
And then you
honor.
Sold the security tags too,
security
right?
Tag.
You know the security tags on shirts when like you shop at the department store. But he plated them in like 14 karat and platinum or 24 karat.
Yeah, 18 karat. 18
karat
gold
plated
with diamonds.
Security. Tags.
Yeah, it was a little ostentatious.
I liked it though. Those were like maybe like how much were those? Like
five? With the diamond, it was like 700.
Yeah,
without the diamond, it was like 400.
Yeah. But you could pin it on any article clothing.
Put it on your sweatshirt, and it looks like you stole it from the nicest store ever. I like that Jeff's plugging all of my art. Thank you. Yeah. This is good.
This is before he had a real job.
Yeah, funny enough. It was all while I was freelancing, so that's good. Also, I feel like a lot of pressure because Jeff's here, so I had to wear good sneakers using my Gatorade Air Jordan 1s. So I did that for you.
You did well.
So, thanks. I couldn't get your shoes, so they sold out.
I got you.
I went on the website. All right, good. So easy questions, warm-up questions. Do you ever sleep?
I strategically sleep.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, what's that? How do you do that?
I have the ability to sort of like... take very strategic naps. So I took one just before coming here.
Okay.
And it was like, I think it was 5:30. I set my alarm for 5:45, took a 15-minute like deep sleep, like went straight into like dream REM mode.
Amazing.
And then alarm went on and I woke up and it's like, it's kind of like when you plug in your iPhone for like 15 minutes, you know, you just get enough juice.
Yeah,
exactly. And I actually, I do a lot of sleep research on my own. And I read that all you need is 15. If you go the hour nap, which is what most people do, it actually makes you groggier when you try to wake up.
Yeah.
It's 15 and 30. Same with sleep cycles. It's like 4 is better than 6. You know, so if you can get 8 hours of sleep, it's great. But 8 is actually 2 cycles of 4. The right cadence is 4.
Yeah, we're learning so much. So you do like 4 hours a night and then
Well, if I look at my tomorrow schedule and I'm like, all right, I'm only going to get like 6 hours of sleep, I'll just work 2 more hours so I get 4 hours of sleep. Yeah.
I feel like I got to try that now. All right, I like this.
I'm insane about time management, you know.
Yeah.
Like it's just all about maximizing every minute and hour, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, and that's how you get so much done and how you get here. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. What's your favorite curse word?
My favorite curse word? Jerk.
Okay, that's good.
Jerk is a good one.
Yeah.
You know, like, honestly, like, nowadays, like, when you call someone any, like, shit, fucking asshole, dick, dipshit, like, whatever,
it's
like...
It's endearing.
Yeah, it's just like, whatever, you asshole, you know?
Yeah.
But when you're like, you're a fucking jerk, dude. Like, you're like, what did I do? Right? Jerk is strong now.
Now, I almost felt offended. That's good. I like it. No one's ever said jerk on this podcast in 23 episodes, so that's a good first one. All right. And last easy question. Have you ever worn Velcro sneakers?
Not in a while.
I feel like that's the little tip. That's the next thing.
Yeah, the dad shoe.
The dad shoe with the Velcro.
Yeah. I mean, I have Velcro on shoes, but not with no laces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when Jeff drops the Velcro pigeon next year, you'll know where it came from. Where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
I'm from the very exotic, remote destination, New Jersey. Yeah.
Maybe some jersey. We didn't get a woo, so probably not. They always woo. Wow, oh, there's one back there. All right, good.
One jersey, all right.
Or one brave enough to say jersey. Yeah. Yeah, so jersey about 30 minutes out, you know, freehold.
Yeah. Did you grow up in a creative household? Or?
No, I grew up in a very, you know, my parents were immigrants. They came here just specifically to have me, basically. They wanted the first person in their whole lineage to have a U.S. passport. That was the whole thing. So my mom flew here when she was like 7 months pregnant, had me, and then I was like, yeah, the only one. And then, you know, went to college, the first one in our clan to go to college, you know. And if any of you are sort of Asian American, you'll know this is sort of like the go-to job for an immigrant. They were like delivering and importing, exporting like fortune cookies and like soy sauce.
Wow.
Literally, yeah. And they had a little warehouse on Franklin Street in Tribeca, which is now like a multi-billion dollar like furniture store. It's called Our House, I think, but that was their warehouse. And so I would come into the city all the time from Jersey, you know, so I was very versed in New York City. Yeah. And they didn't have any idea what like a creative profession was, you know. Even after I got the job of like being a creative, they didn't understand what I did for like a decade. Like they didn't understand.
I feel like that's the case of most kids who pursue creative passions. Like, yeah. you're always willing. Like, yeah, my parents don't really get it, but that's okay.
Yeah, I remember. I used to be the art director of this magazine called The Fader, which some of you might be aware of. But I started issue 2 of The Fader, and then I designed like the first 20 issues of The Fader. And I was so proud of the first issue, you know, hot off the press, like perfect binding, 200 pages, right? Like
smelled so good.
Yeah, just heavy, you know, really good stock. And I showed it to my mom, and she's like, you made this magazine? I was like, yeah, I did the whole thing, you know? She's like, you mean you like printed it? Like, you were the printer?
Yeah.
I was like, no, I didn't print it. She's like, oh, like, you wrote all the articles? I'm like, no, I didn't do that. She's like flipping. She's like, oh, so you shot all the photos? Like, you took all the pictures?
Yeah.
No, I didn't do that. She's like, what do you do? Like, I don't understand. You didn't...
Way to deflate
you
completely.
Where are you in this process?
I don't see your picture anywhere. I don't know what you do.
Yeah. I was like, no, someone has to lay it out and, you know...
My heart's breaking a little bit for you right now. Where'd you go to college before then?
So after high school, I went to New York University. Again, I didn't think there was any real career in creativity or like being a designer or anything. So I picked journalism. I liked writing. I was into creative writing, but I didn't think you could make money being a journalist either. So tried journalism. And I don't know if you remember like Connie Chung. But like to be like my parents were like every nightly news, they'd be like, you could be Connie Chung, you could be on TV like being a journalist. I was like, oh, OK, I'll try that. Yeah. So did journalism.
It's amazing how important representation is, right?
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, you could do that.
It is. Yeah. I know. They also wanted me to be a pro tennis player after Michael Chang like came out. I'm dead ass serious.
Yeah. That's incredible.
So, yeah, journalism for 2 years. And then I left. You know, basically got a taste of what it means to be working as a designer by taking an internship and like little odd jobs in the city. Stumbled upon a data entry clerk job at a desktop publishing studio, which I guess is like the precursor to a graphic design studio, right? And that was the first time I just saw people like doing graphic design. I was like, man, this is so cool. So I wanted to take classes at NYU. And they didn't offer really any good classes back then. There was no design department yet in the early 90s. And so I quit NYU and then transferred to Parsons School of Design with no portfolio except my high school and middle school sketches. That was all I didn't know what a portfolio was.
Yeah.
They just said, bring your work. So I brought like trapper keepers.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I was just like, here's my work. I made these comics when I was like, in eighth grade, you know, and
no concept of what you're actually supposed to be presenting. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And
they thought it was adorable.
Yes.
And
they said no.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so the guidance, you know, admissions counselor was like, "Yeah, this you're not strong enough to get in." You know, like I'm sorry. And as a side note, as a strange thing, at the time, do you guys remember rollerblading, like inline skating? It was like huge back then. Okay. Yeah. Like, and I worked at Paragon.
Especially in the city, like it was actually cool. Like,
It was cool. I swear to you, for 2 years it was cool. And I worked at Paragon Sporting Goods in Union Square, and I was selling skates and sneakers, okay? And I was giving lessons too. And so I skated to the interview, to the interview, right? And so I had my skates, did the interview. She said, no, you're not good enough, right? And then she calls me to tell me that you're not good enough and we're rejecting you. And I was like, okay, fine. And she's like, but I noticed you skated to the interview. I was like, yeah. And she's like, would you be down to like give me a lesson? And I was like, oh. I was like,
was that like flirting, or was it she just legitimately needed a lesson?
I was like, sure, when do you want to do it? She's like, how about like 10 p.m. tonight? Right? So I go and give her a lesson. And
how you got into art school. Yeah.
One thing leads to another. We end up dating for 6 months, and I end up getting into Parsons somehow. I swear. And it was like,
that might be against the admission standards.
Yeah.
It was, well done.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a hustler.
I know. Yeah. I have very low standards. I will do anything for that.
Wow.
But I ended up, it was a great relationship. But we had to hide it and stuff. You know, it was pretty interesting. And it was awesome because, like, at Parsons, like, when you register for classes, it's hard. Some of these classes, like, right? You remember the days, like, you try to register for a class. Oh, it's locked up. It's booked. I can't get in. I don't want to say her name, but, like, I'm like, yo. I'm like, yo, V, like, I can't get into this class. She's like, hit refresh, check now. Available. I was like, whoa.
This is already the best episode of Overshare ever.
Hey, how'd you get to college? I slapped my way in.
But I got good. I got good.
You got good. And so then you did 2 years of Parsons.
Yeah, and then I did two years Parsons. Yep. And then I ended up...
And then who'd you sleep with for your next job?
Well, I ended up... I actually ended up starting Staple out of Parsons my second year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I started it out of school. I took a silk screening class, and I was just, you know, it was a silk screening class for like posters and stuff. Yeah. And I started on posters, and then I started to just bring t-shirts in, and I started printing on t-shirts. And the professor was like, hey, what are you doing here? I was like, oh, I'm just making tees. I was bored of paper, you know, like I give posters to my friends and it's so corny. Like, what are you gonna do? Put it up, frame it in your fucking studio apartment or your dorm room, right? Yeah, yeah. So I was like, I like t-shirts because I give them and then like I see them in school all the time. Like people wear them.
Cool.
It's pretty cool, right? I was like, that's a great form of communication. And she's like, yeah, you can't print on t-shirts here. I was like, well, why not? I'm like, I'm actually doing it. So why not? And she's like, you just can't. And I was like, man, fuck that shit. So like, I would leave the window open in the silkscreen lab, and then I would break in at night with a friend. So me and one buddy would pack pillowcases full of t-shirts. We would throw them in through the unlocked window. We would then climb in through the window, and then all night when there was no students in the building, we would be silkscreening shirts all night long.
I love in the 90s they didn't have security cameras.
They did, but like, you know, you could work, you could go to school at all night, right? So we would walk in and we would just walk past security, nod, and then like throw in the bags, you know? And it was awesome. That guy ended up working for Wieden & Kennedy in Tokyo. And I ended up actually doing the thing, like continuing to do that. And
did you start selling them to your friends or how did you,
like, I gave them to my friends.
Business, yeah.
Yeah, gave them to my friends, strictly an art project.
What were the first images? Did they just say Staple or the?
No. There was no logos at all. It was really, I was using it as really a high concept art project. So I was doing like moments in history that we should never forget. Like, so I would do like the Tiananmen Square student uprising. I did like the Native American massacre. I did like the African American slave trade, like these really big areas and like have illustrations and stuff. And so I was giving those away. And then I wore one of the shirts to a store in Soho at the time on Lafayette. It was called the 555 Soul Store, and it was like a sort of streetwear boutique. And I was wearing one of my shirts, and the manager just said, like, yo, it's a cool shirt. Where'd you get that? And I said, I made it. And he was like, wow, you want to make 12 and put them in the shop? And I was like, fuck yeah. You know, so I made 12. Again, breaking into school, had to make 12. Then sold them, and they sold out right away. And then he's like, I want to get another one, but now 24. And then another store in Soho called Union, which is a legendary streetwear store. Yeah, they have an LA store now. They caught wind and they were like, we want 12, 24, 36. So I'm like ping-ponging sort of, I got up to like about 50 shirts per design, back and forth for each store, while breaking into school.
Yeah.
And then a Japanese guy one day goes to Union, he buys one of the shirts, takes it back to Japan, and then he calls me and he's like, hey, I got your shirt from Union. He actually said, I got your shirt from Union. And and then And I was, he's like, I want to buy more. I was like, whoa, that's all. He called me at, on my home landline, okay? Because back then, on the hang tag of
the
shirt.
Should we explain what landlines are?
Yes.
Yeah. Had a cord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bell Atlantic.
Yeah.
So he called me on my home line. I actually had my home phone number on my business card back then. So he called me and I said, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll send it to you in Japan. Like, how many do you want? He's like, oh, I want like 1,000. Yeah. So I was like, and I was just doing 50 shirt orders, you know, so it went from like 50 to 1,000.
How many could you put out in a night of breaking in?
So I could make about 100, but 50 of them would be too fucked up. Like,
right.
They'd be damaged.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right,
so
right.
50 would be
you
good.
You weren't very good at silk screening.
No, right, right. No. And actually, the reason why the teacher didn't want me to do silk screening there, because it was not made for shirts.
Okay.
And it was just, like, yeah. I'd be duct taping shirts down and trying to hold it together, you know.
Yeah. Cardboard or whatever.
Yeah, it was all makeshift jerry-rigged. Yeah. So I got the 1,000 shirt order, started to even think about how I would do that in school. Impossible, right? I can't print 1,000 shirts breaking in the school. So I just started looking around, and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to... I guess it was a good moment in the semester break, and I was like, I'm going to... School's always going to be here. I'm going to take a break. I'll probably fail miserably, and I'll just come back the next semester, you know? So I quit school at that time, and then I never looked back. I haven't gone back to school yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you care?
I have an honorary degree.
Hell yeah. That's awesome. That's
I got
great.
The Parsons. So a couple of years later, the Dean of Parsons said, we're making a coffee table book of like our top 30 graduates, right? And so Anna Sui, Alexander
of
Wang.
Of all time. Yeah.
Yeah, like yeah. 30, yeah. You know, and we want to include you in the book. It was the alumni book, right? Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm not alumni. Yeah. And he was like, I got you. So yeah, now
Wait. Did you date him too?
Yeah. He's very handsome.
Yeah.
He's very, very handsome. But it's sick. Now in Parsons, there's a hallway where it's like A. Wang, Anna Sui, DKNY, like, and then me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Breaking
that's,
into school.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're just like sneaking in through a window in the photo. Yeah. But that's like, you just got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that's the moral of the story, right? When someone tells you no, like, just find another way. Find another way in, you know? And I always think, like, so many times, like, what if I just listened to the teacher and I just said, like, yeah, I probably shouldn't be printing in here, you know? Or if the guy who placed the order of 12, I was like, I'm not going to make 12 shirts and sell them in a store. Or if the Japanese guy, I was like, how am I going to make 1,000? Fuck that. And just shut it down. Like, so many times I could have, like, stopped, like, not gone forward with it, you know? It's almost like the idiocracy of it is what made it successful.
Because you were so naive, you didn't know any better.
Yeah.
So you're like, yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah, even when the shirts started to do really well, and that same store manager was like, yo, you're like one of the best-selling brands in the store, and it was still just T-shirts. Yeah. He was like, if you made like a hoodie, I think people will buy it. And I was like, okay, let me look up how to make a hoodie. You know, make a bag, people buy it. Look up how to make a bag. That's how my line grew. I wasn't like, I'm going to be a fashion
and
designer.
And this is early to mid-90s.
This is 97.
So this isn't like you can go on YouTube and say how to make a hoodie.
No, it was Yellow Pages. Yeah. I opened the Yellow Pages, and I'm like, silk screeners. Okay, call all of them, yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And then so did you continue doing the clothing line? Did you get like a real job or a full-time job at any point?
Nope.
Nope,
just been doing that. The reason why Staple Design today is a clothing line and a design studio is because at Parsons, I was a communication design major, so I was like a graphic designer. And I already had a lot of like clients. When I say clients, I mean like design my CD cover, design my mixtape cover, like, you know, like design my logo for like a band or whatever, right? So it was that shit. And I was doing that, and I love doing that. So when the clothing line started to take off, I was like, I still love doing this sort of like client work, so I want to keep that going. So I decided to sort of like separate it and maintain both of it. And that still runs today, probably more successfully than the clothing line, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's more profitable than the clothing line.
Well, I read a couple things.
Maybe.
I read a couple things that you, at one point, were living in an actual sweatshop when you started this.
Yeah. So when the clothing line started to do well, this is probably a year and a half, 2 years in, 99, right? Yeah. I had a studio apartment in Chinatown, probably about half the size of this room, where I lived in and Staple was out of. So if you can imagine kitchen, industrial, metro shelving, there was a maze that you can walk through, but everything else was metro shelving with shirts stacked in it. That was my operations.
It was a warehouse, yeah.
Yeah, and a bed there.
Yeah.
And so I moved finally to, I was what I was doing was I was looking for a factory in New York that could make my stuff. And so I was looking for factories, found one on Grand and Center. Okay, if you guys know that neighborhood well, there's a diner there called the Landmark Diner, yeah, right on
my
Grand and Center.
My office is a block away, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So above the Landmark Diner, you'll see like this whole sort of wraparound building. That was a factory. I went into the factory, and it was totally empty, but all the machines were there, but there wasn't a single person in there.
Like sewing machines? Or
all the sewing machines were in there, right? And like all the lights and everything. And so I meet the landlord. I'm like, what happened to the factory? And they're like, oh, this is a sweatshop. So it got shut down like last week. And I was like, oh, shit. So there's no factory. He's like, nope. He's like, but if you know of anyone who wants to rent this space, let me know. And I was like, how much? And it's a 3,000 square foot space. And he said, I'm renting it for $3,000, a dollar a square foot, which is like, I was paying like $1,200 a month for a studio. So I was like, $3,000, I could operate Staple out of here. I need one roommate, but it's a massive space and I can do this, you know? So I was like, okay, I'm going to take this space. And he's like, for real? I was like, yeah. So I took the space and that's where the first real Staple office was.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And were you doing stitching and sewing?
Yeah, sewing machines, inventory, yeah. That's my roommate was like, he was like a handy builder guy, so he built all the rooms, built the loft space. It was a dope space. I mean, if you ever look at it now, you'll see how big it is. It, like, you could count 18 windows, like, all around. The whole thing was ours.
How long did you stay in there?
A long time. I mean, at least, I don't know, 5-6 years, I think. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That's great. And I heard, also, I read that your first ads had Mos Def in them?
Yeah. So, one of the clients that we had early on was this record label called Raucous, which was soon to become like one of the most important hip-hop record labels of all time. They sort of hosted...
Wasn't Naughty by Nature on them?
No. No, it was Mos Def, Talib Kweli, Common, Black Star, Company Flow, DJ Spinna. Yeah, just like conscious hip-hop level, sort of like, you know, No ID started there.
Right.
Eminem's first appearances on the B side of a DJ Spinna album, you know, so stuff like that. So I was there designing their merch. So Staple had already, the clothing line had already been quite popular, and so they saw that and they were like, "Can you design our merchandise?"
That's great.
So I was like, "Cool." Started to help them with their merch. So if you ever see a Raucous T-shirt or a Raucous messenger bag, like I probably designed that and made it. And then they would be like, hey, since you're here, can you help out with this album cover real quick, you know? So we started to do the album packages, like...
And did you have help? Like, how many people were working with you at Staple Design?
No.
Oh, so it was you.
It was still just me. Yeah. But if you, like, I don't know if you guys know, like, the Lyricist Lounge or, like, Sound Bombing designed all those things. And it was a special time. And so, like, Mos Def was always there, right? And, like, Common was always there. And so one day I'm in the elevator with Mos, and I show him, like, our new, like, clothes, you know, and I was like, would you be down to be like our model? He's like, yeah. And I was like, okay, when? He's like, let's just do it right now in the elevator. So we did a shoot like right there in the elevator in the lobby, and then that ended up being like the first ad. It was like Mos Def as our first spokesperson.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and then we got the Roots after that, but like now it sounds so incredible. But back then, like, no one gave a shit about...
Well, it was people just hanging out.
Yeah, it was, like, Mos Who, like, the Roots, what? Like, no one cared, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even Common, like, I was designing Common's album with him. And,
which album?
1999.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a 12-inch single, actually. But the 12-inch package. And, he was like, do you think... He's like, I want to get a picture of a kid on the cover. I want, like, a kid breakdancing. And he's like, but I don't have pictures of my kid. Like, do you think you can ask Mos for pictures of his kid? And we'll use that. And I was like, Mos, can we use pictures of your kid? It was like, that's how innocent it was back then, yeah.
And everybody was just starting off, so.
Exactly, yeah. And now it's like legendary status, you know? Yeah, and to me, the last incredible golden era of hip hop, you know?
For sure.
Yeah.
And then, like, what was the hardest part? You know, I feel like you just kind of were like winging everything. But like starting a business as a creative person is pretty tough.
Yeah.
Because we didn't go to school for business. You didn't.
No.
And so what were like the hardest parts in the early days and then maybe as you went along of trying to be a business person, a businessman?
Probably the overarching hardest part is like, you know, as you guys know, when you're a creative, you tend to be like very controlling of what your output is, right? You're like a control freak. You're probably OCD. You know, you're probably very demanding on yourself.
Yeah,
perfectionist, right? So... Now imagine you have that same mentality, but now you have a business, okay? But it's not just about designing now, right? It's about like balancing the checkbook. It's about taking out the trash. It's about making sure your assistant's paid on time, like all of these things. And if you apply that same level of like OCD-ness and controlness to everything, right, like opening bills, right, then you can't, you just can't parse it out anymore. Like you can't possibly be OCD about paying bills and balancing a checkbook and creating amazing t-shirts and making an amazing lookbook and making sure it's printed on time.
Because everything becomes the most important thing.
Yeah. And I was going through that for like the first 5 years, just driving myself crazy.
Would you waste a bunch of time designing invoices like I did?
Yes.
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 Anybody else over-design their invoices? Hell yeah.
Now my invoices, by the way, here's a pro tip. My invoices now is an Excel spreadsheet. It's a template. Yeah, I feel like there's a. I feel like
accountants don't give a shit about what typeface or your.
No, and I feel like when you submit an invoice to like a corporation and it's too overly designed, they're like rookie, right?
Oh yeah, I used to design all my invoices in InDesign, and then I even. All right, so this is how bad mine were. When someone would pay me, I had a paid stamp in InDesign that I would put on, and I'd put like it at a different angle in a different placement.
You would rotate. You would hand rotate it.
And I'm the only person who saw it. That it was paid, but I'm like, oh, they put my paid stamp and with the date. I'm like, there it is. Oh, a little angle. Oh, and I put multiply on it so it looked like it was stamped over.
Gaussian blur, like.
Yeah. No wonder why I'm not productive at all. Spending time designing stamps. Nobody sees.
Microsoft Word for your invoices or Excel.
Yeah.
That's
Don't
it.
Don't waste your time, guys.
Yeah.
Hard lesson learned.
But So learning to delegate, essentially. And like, you know, I even had help back then. Like, I'd have friends just down the help. And I'd be like, yeah, come over and help out. And they would just be sitting there, like, because I wouldn't let them actually do anything. You know, like, I'd be like, can you count that box to make sure it's got, like, 60 shirts in it? And then they'd be like, yeah, it's 60. I was like, let me do it once also. Like, and I'd count the box as well, you know, because I'm just so OCD about it. Yeah.
And how much better have you gotten with all that since then?
Delegation?
Yeah.
I would say that's probably, like, one of the number one reasons for me being successful at all is the ability now to let go, quarterback, and trust the process. And like, I brought you, I interviewed you, I met you, I know you now, I trust you, now go do it. And if you fuck up, it's totally fine because it's on me that I trusted you, but you can go out and do whatever the F you want right now because I've beholden you with that responsibility. That's my mentality. And I don't micromanage, you know, I want to empower people to like teach me some shit, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, if you hire people that are better or even give people opportunity to do the things that you're not good at.
Yeah.
Because I think we like to pretend that we're good at everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're like, well, I'm not really that good at accounting. You know, and it's like that other stuff. And I should probably hire people to help me with that stuff.
Right.
And I think that's gone a long way for me, too. It's letting go of that control, which is really hard to do.
Yeah.
But once you do, it's super freeing.
Yeah, you could really only be good at, like, and good, I mean, like, A-plus good at only a certain number of things. Everything else starts to fall off. And then you really shouldn't be wasting your time on it because you're wasting you're not only preventing yourself from doing the A plus thing that you could be doing, but you're probably like balancing your checkbooks incorrectly at the same time. So it's like counterintuitive.
Or even reluctantly because you're not that good at it, so you don't want to do it. You're procrastinating on it.
Yeah.
And then it's taking all of this brain space away from like the one or two things that you're saying that you're good at.
I'm very good now at like listening to my gut and being like, I don't like this. This is annoying me. Delegate right away. Like just shove it off to someone who can do this well and loves to do it. Yeah.
That's great.
Yep.
I noticed from the start, the tagline for Staple was a positive social contagion.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd that come from? And like, why was that important for you to put out there?
It's been our tagline since 1998. Positive social contagion, if you break down each word, the reason why I felt I needed a tagline like that is because we were doing so many things like clothing, streetwear, sneaker design, magazines, album covers, you know, all that stuff. And it was hard for us to be like, Staple, the best clothing line, you know, or like, you know, Staple, we make albums. Like, it wasn't like that. So I wanted sort of a vague thing. And so positive social contagion, positive to me is like, I was very inspired still from like leaving school and actually being able to support myself and a small sort of crew of employees. So I think just going out there and following like your instinct and your dreams, I mean, it sounds sappy, but it's like, it's true. Positive to me doesn't necessarily mean like save the earth or like, you know, like save the whales type thing. Just positive means like believe in yourself, trust yourself, and then go and do it, right? Social means everything we do is for the people, and then contagion means everything that we do spreads from one to another. So as long as it encapsulates all of those things, it's positive moving forward and it's like spreads, then we can do it.
Yeah. It's a great spirit. I mean, it's not pigeonhole, no pun intended.
Yeah.
Not pigeonholing yourself into one discipline.
Yeah.
You know, like, we can do anything as long as it, you know, delivers on that.
Yeah. The same thing goes with the name. Like, when I named the company Staple, it was also like, all we're about is like, the name came from like the definition of staple, like sort of essential elements that you can't live without. And the reason why I named it that, ironically, is because, as I mentioned, I was like really into hip hop early on, and like, you know, sort of the true hip hop, right? Not like rap. And in the early 90s, the big fashion brands that were out from like Urban Clothing, which was like Sean John, Rockaware, like, you know, FUBU, right? That was another one. Like, yeah. It was just like they represented hip hop culture. But I would never wear that stuff. So it's like, I don't get it. You're supposed to be hip-hop clothing, but I love hip-hop, but I don't want to wear your stuff. So where's the disconnect? So I was like, a lot of my early designs were like hip-hop, but for me and like the people that like my kind of hip-hop, I guess. And it was more about...
You found your audience that way, yeah.
Yeah, and it was more about the essential elements of hip-hop. So that was why Staple was named after like the essential elements. But later on, it became like sort of such a generic word that it could apply to like anything, like, yeah.
It had legs and breath.
Yeah.
But you've been around now. Staple's been around for, what, 20, 21 years?
Yep. Last year was our 20th anniversary.
How the hell do you stay relevant for 20 years?
I just did an interview today for High Snobiety, and they didn't tell me what the topic was. They just said, we want to interview you, right? And then the...
Great. What was it?
Ageism and streetwear. I was like, me? Really? Like, so I'm that guy now? I'm going to be like...
Give me a fucking heads up on that?
The senior league. Yeah. Wow. So yeah, it was all about that. So it was a lot about like, how do I stay relevant and stuff like that. And I don't even know if I am relevant or if I, you know, it's not really a goal of mine to wake up and stay relevant. I think that's probably one of the secrets, to be honest. Like, when I put something out there, if I put a shoe out there, I'm not like, will this make me relevant? Will I be down with the youth if I do this? You know, like How do I stay lit? You know, whatever the word is, you know what I mean? Or drip. Does this have drip? Yeah. So I think it's
you
more...
You can't overthink it. You just got to...
Yeah, and it's more like, do I like it? And do like the people within my 6 degrees that I really trust like it? And the problem is, if you do it that way, you will have some misses, right? And everything won't be perfectly on trend and hyped exactly right, but in the long run, like, I think you're gonna win if you just... It's corny, but like, stay true to yourself. Like, but I think it's true. Like, you just...
Well, you can go and start reacting to what the trends are, and then you're behind them. And then if you got to just do stuff. Like, I think that's what a lot of us try to do. Like, what do I think is cool, and are my friends into it, who I show around here?
Yeah.
And if we're into it, then cool. That's enough.
That's easier said than done, because I think a lot of people, especially in this very sort of judgmental world of, like, you know, you put your work up, like, everyone at every scale has gone through this, right? You put your work out there, and I'm holding a phone, but like, you put your work out there and you're just like, holy cow, why aren't people like liking this? Like, why are there no, like, should I delete it now? Like, this, that anxiety, like, is overwhelming.
So you still suffer from that too?
Yeah, for sure, you know? But like, so everyone suffers from that, just know that. But the next step is having the wherewithal to be like, fuck it, I liked it. I don't care if this didn't get 1,000 likes, it only got 200 likes, but like, so be it. Like, I'm proud of it, you know? That takes a lot of courage. And I know a lot of people, especially the people who are like sort of big on social media. Like, I have a friend who's got like, he has over 500,000 followers, and like, he posts a picture and the anxiety that I see on his face is insane. Like, he hits refresh every second, and if he doesn't get 100 likes every second for the first 10 seconds, he deletes the photo.
Wow.
Yeah, he's like, no, that's bad, delete.
That is giving me anxiety just hearing about it. Yeah.
Oh my God. Or
that's gotta be like crushing. And it's like, I think a lot of people suffer from, suffering from caring a lot about what other people think. Mm-hmm. And then you have this scorecard now that's Instagram.
Yes.
And just like trying to judge your success or failures based on other people's numbers too.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting when Jack Dorsey said, like, he was in front of Congress and he said, I think, you know, we might have prioritized the numbers too much in the hierarchy of our design. Mm-hmm. And maybe that shouldn't be the thing that we're focusing on.
Yeah. But now that this game has started, like, good luck trying to delete that whole thing now. You know? I was having on that High Snob interview that I did today, we were talking about imagine, you know, you were in high school, and you remember in high school there was like the most popular guy in class, usually like you, right?
No, it was definitely not me.
Okay, no, but like, you know, it's like the high, you know, the starting quarterback, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Or like the starting cheerleader was like the most popular girl in school. And then there was like, you were the nerd because like you were in the parking lot only and no one wanted, or you were sitting in lunch by yourself. Yeah. It was like sort of these like.
Or you smelled weird.
Yeah, it was like just these like little pockets sort of started to develop. But there was no like analytical data that said he was the most popular kid in school. But now there is. Like, I don't know if any of you have kids in high school, but I'd be fascinated to know if like the person who has the most followers and the most sort of like stickiness on social is crowned now the most popular person in school.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And there's a number two and a number three, and the number one can lose the spot to number two. Like, imagine that anxiety.
You're
like
just getting more followers because your YouTube videos about, you know, acne care, you're just doing yeah. way better than that other kid. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's the analytics now that
that's
is like
kids talk about, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No, but it's the numbers game is like really what's hindering everything, I think, yeah. now.
Well, and do you think that has an effect on creativity?
Absolutely, because, yeah. You know, you said I did a lot of the early stuff I did out of like innocence and like just almost stupidity. If I was being judged publicly by doing that stuff, then I would not be doing it. I wouldn't have the courage to like put myself out there to be like judged and clicked and retweeted and stuff.
It would have been so discouraging that
yeah.
you put out like this new shirt design you're really proud of,
mm-hmm.
and you got 10 likes.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Like I got a 12 shirt order, which in the grand scheme of things is nothing. Yeah. But in that moment, I like hit the lotto.
Yeah.
You know, but like if I was comparing myself to others, I'd be like, only a 12 shirt order? Nah, bro. I'm not fulfilling that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, and I think that's a big thing. Like, for my friend Larry Pipitone, I'll shout him out. He said, you know, we need to do a better job of celebrating wins at whatever level in your career you're at.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's easy. You go and say, all right, I'm looking at Jeff Staple, or I'm looking at all these other people, and you're just starting out.
Yeah.
And that's not a fair comparison. And no. So, like, how do we go and get excited that we got a 12 shirt order?
Yeah,
today,
right.
And how do we get excited that I got one more follower, I got a buyer, I got one order off my website, and that's a big deal,
mm-hmm.
and celebrate that as opposed to feeling like a failure constantly because you're not hitting these numbers.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not
exactly.
easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I feel like you do. It seems like you do a lot of mentorship and things to help younger designers and educate them. I know you have a Skillshare class and
yes.
all that stuff, but it seems like that's an important thing to you, like help bring people up.
Yeah. And you know, I think like I'm 43 years old right now. When I turned 35, I think I made a conscious decision to be like, all right, I understand that I'm in an industry where my customer base is like 16, possibly up to like, you know, 20. So I deal with a very young consumer base. I'm now 35. My peers, meaning like the guys that I hang out with who are 35, have like two kids, are divorced, have like, you know, like a white picket fence house, right? And I'm sitting here like trying to get this kid at Zoomies to like buy my t-shirt, right? So I'm quickly either going to be like the old guy at the nightclub who's trying to hit on like the 21-year-old, you know, like I'm gonna be that guy, or I'm gonna have to take a different stance and sort of take a more like mentorship route and like try to like elevate and, you know, bring up the next generation instead of like trying to be down so hard, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it seems like your stuff connects with a broad range though of consumers and audience, and it's not just the kids, which, you know, it's still, I would still rock the stuff that you make, and obviously I do.
Yeah.
And so it's not, I don't think it's so like youth focused.
Oh,
it's
thanks.
Like you're just,
there's something
like
for everybody a
yeah,
little bit.
Yeah, it still
bit.
Seems like you're making some stuff for your friends.
Yeah.
You know, and
yep.
for you. So we'll go back to 2005. I don't know if everybody knows the story.
Okay.
What 2005 was the pigeon Nike Dunk SB.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yes.
like, 100 feet that way,
yes.
200 feet that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, where we made like sneaker history, whatever.
Yeah.
It depends on the crowd that I talk to. Like,
yeah.
I feel like this crowd won't care about that much, but basically we released the sneaker with Nike and kids slept for like 4 or 5 days outside. And then when we opened the doors, like it got really, really contentious and a riot broke out, fighting. NYPD had to come and New York SWAT had to come. People brought baseball bats and knives and everything to this event to like try to mug people who got the shoes, and
there was like only like 20 pairs or something.
No, there was
the
150.
100,
yeah,
but still
very
not
limited,
a lot for
yeah.
a crowd. Yeah,
and then people got arrested and stuff, and then the evening news, like NBC, CBS News came to report on it. New York Post came to report on it, and then it was on the front page of the Post the next day. Right. And so that
I've seen that cover in your office.
Yeah. So yeah, that yeah. just sort of like catapulted, because before then, sneaker culture was just like a very niche underground thing. And after that, people were like, what? People are lining up for shoes, you know? And then also, like, the whole sort of aftermarket thing, too. Thank you. Like, that shoe that we did, you know, the wholesale price was $32. The retail price was $75. And the next day, that shoe on eBay was, like, $300. And now, if you try to find that shoe on eBay, it's, like, $10,000.
I went on StockX today. It was $13,500.
$13,500? Yeah. So it's on the rise, like, after a decade. And that's a shoe. You know, I'm not talking about, like, a bottle of wine or a watch. So it's, like, it's pretty amazing. But it's also, like, I always try to understand that that was a moment in time and try to advance sort of, like, beyond that. But it really did amazing things for, like, the recognition of me and the notoriety of the brand.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Is it hard when you have a success like that? Because you were, 30 at the time, around there?
Five. I guess so.
Yeah. Yes. But, like, hitting like, a moment like that where you're like, oh, shit, like, people are really into my thing, does that put a lot of pressure on you for the next thing?
No.
Or do you not, you didn't worry about it?
No, because it wasn't a classic yet. Like, a classic is, like, no one tells you that, like, hey, Jeff, you just did something that in 10 years people are going to still be talking about. Like, every year I figured people will stop talking about this thing, right? Like, and then, like, I remember 10 years in, Complex Magazine wanted to do, like, a mini 10-minute documentary on the 10-year anniversary release of the Pigeon Dog. They went back and interviewed all the police officers that worked the beat, the reporter who broke the story, like, all the people. They interviewed everyone, and, like,
wow.
Like, you know, like,
that's incredible.
It was incredible. And yeah. not funded by me or any. They just went and did it on their own. And I was like, wow, it's awesome. And then I remember 2 years after that, like 12 years later, the Wall Street Journal runs a story about sneaker culture, and they put the Pigeon Dunk in, like, this amazing, like, Fabergé egg kind of, like, display. Like, 75% of the whole entire spread was the Pigeon Dunk. I was like, there we go again, you know, and then another documentary called Sneakerheads comes out, and then, like, that's a great documentary if you guys want to watch it, but they focus on that again, you know, so it's like...
Well, wasn't there a sneaker exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum? Or,
yes.
Yeah, and I saw it was your personal pair that was in there, too. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
In the Brooklyn Museum, it was, like, on display, and so...
It's gonna be surreal.
Yeah, it is, but, like... When it happened back then, I wasn't like, oh, this is going to be legendary, you know? Yeah. It took
stressing
time.
Stressing the fuck out because people are fighting each other outside the store.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And even after, I mean, even a year after, 2 years after, just like, yeah, that was a good thing, but you don't know, you know what I mean? Yeah.
It's so just keeping it in perspective. Did you have any stuff after that where you put it out and you thought people would love it and it just didn't connect?
Yeah, all the time. I mean... Not really in the collaboration world. The collaboration world is sort of set up for success because there's a lot of, like, pre-planning involved, and there's usually another entity, you know, that makes sure that everything's going to really be, like, a home run. Yeah, I mean, these were okay. Like, you know, they sold out in 2 hours, which is, like, it didn't sell out in 5 minutes, I guess.
So that's the benchmark. So you're like, 2 hours did okay.
The benchmark is, like we did a Nike last November, and we sold, like...
Is that the all-black one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Yeah, I think we sold, like, 25,000 pairs in 30 seconds. It was, like, it was on the app. You know, you get a push notification. This is available.
Yeah.
You touch it, and then it's, like, sold out, all of it. And it's, like, okay, that was good.
Yeah. Yeah, so if that's what you're used to, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, on this one, like, in the second hour, I was, like, pulling my hair out. Like, what's going on?
Yeah. It's been... Stressing out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's a thing, too, with, like, the SB is just, like, iconic, and people are...
Yeah.
So you have a podcast now.
Yeah.
Business of Hype.
Yep.
So you just finished season two. You're about to launch season three, you told me.
Yeah.
Soon you're talking to amazing people.
Yeah.
Sarah from Colette. And,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was... I'm a big fan of podcasts, listening to them. And then Hypebeast, which is... Hypebeast.com is kind of like the Condé Nast of our culture, I guess, right? Like the Vogue of us. The president was like, we're going to start a radio station, and if you want, like, we'll give you a show. Like, think of an idea for a show if you're down. So I was like, all right, cool. I'm down to do that. And because I was a fan of podcasts, I always thought, like, I could make one of these, you know? And no one has really... sort of taken the business route of, like, if you added Forbes and Hypebeast together and talked about the realities of it, like starting a t-shirt brand, you know, trying to get work at a sneaker brand or whatever, or even opening an art gallery or a store, like, what does it take? You know, like, how much money, how many employees do you need, all that stuff? Like, how much debt do you have to get into?
The realities of it. Because people only see the highlights.
No, yep.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing about Instagram is that you only show the wins.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you don't show the failures.
I heard a great quote that was, don't compare your blooper reel to other people's highlight reel.
Exactly.
And that's all you see, and you're like, oh, shit. And then you're like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I know. Like, I remember one time.
Fuck up.
I remember one time I was, like, looking at my credit card bill, right? And I'm, like, deciding how much I can pay of it. And then, like, I'm looking at Instagram and, like, my, like, peer and competitor is, like, he's, like, leaning on a Lamborghini, right? And I'm just like, like, that's exactly that moment where it's, like, you know, like, don't compare the blooper reel to
that
the
was a rental, reel. And you had no idea.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was actually photoshopped, probably. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I wanted to do this Business of Hype podcast, and no commitment. I was like, I'll try 3 episodes. And then it just took off right away. I think it really touched something where, like, people wanted to hear these failures, you know?
And it's also like the Wizard of Oz, like behind the curtain, because yeah. You see these brands like Supreme and Kith and Colette, mm-hmm. and you just think it's
all good.
It's all good, and it's the hype, right? Yeah. You just see the lines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So to hear the stories behind it is actually super fascinating.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of courage for these people to come on radio and say these things, you know?
You don't want to ruin the illusion.
I know. It's interesting. Like, I interviewed one of the people you just mentioned, and he heard the interview afterwards, and he's like, I don't want this to be run. Like, he said the words. Like, I didn't put words in his mouth.
Yeah.
And he's like, I was like, why not? He's like, I can't. Like, it's just too real, you know? I was like, oh, you're a puss.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, I didn't run it.
He doesn't want to ruin his billion-dollar brand, yeah.
And it's like, yeah. But nothing in it was bad. It was all really good stuff. But it just shows how much, like, the facade is so important.
Yeah.
You know, well, the smoke and mirrors is, like, so key.
But you even look at people, like, it's hard to be vulnerable on your own Instagram if you're trying to run your own business, if you're trying to, you know, be a creative and try to gain clients. And you don't want to, like, admit you don't know what the fuck you're doing.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, are people going to, like, be attracted to me and want to hire me for my vulnerability? Or they're going to think that I have no idea what I'm doing
because
I'm being too honest.
Right.
And so it's a really difficult balance, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
What's the biggest thing that you've learned from interviewing these people now? Or is there a commonality that you're seeing or a theme and what's gotten them where they are?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of themes. There's so much good, like, gems and nuggets with each person. I don't know. I mean, I suggest you listen to all episodes.
Listen to all 20 guys.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all really good.
But no, I mean, a lot of the typical things that you would imagine, you know, like, we go into the sort of, like, when I say the typical thing, like, you know, follow your dreams, follow your passions, that thing that everyone knows that they're supposed to do, it's the granular nuggets of information in each interview that, like, is really telling, you know, and it's different for each person. Like, if you're going to listen to two, I would suggest you listen to, one is Ben Baller.
That's an insane episode.
And then there's another one, it's a rapper named Shirt, okay? And I think Shirt in 3 years will be a household name. And I interviewed him at a point where he just got signed by Jack White's record label, okay? So he's, like, on the cusp of breaking, but he also, like, can't afford rent right now, you know? And so to hear
That's Ben... kind of a cool moment to catch someone in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to hear Ben Baller, like, go into how much it takes for him to keep his lights on, which is...
$60,000
a month? $60,000 a month is... If he makes $60,000 a month, he doesn't eat, he says. That's to car payment, school... house, mortgage, like, that's 60 grand a month. Like, and he just said that on the air. I was like, wow.
Yeah, the fact that he said it, I was like, oh shit. Well, and you're like, that's a little cocky. Then you're like, well, this guy's not really holding anything back.
He's a cocky dude.
Yeah.
But then you hear about Shirt, and he said this thing where he's like, you know, he's like, when you're broke, like, you don't want to do anything. Like, people don't understand. Like, they're like, oh, like, you should go to the Guggenheim. It's free on Fridays. You just go. Like, he's like, I don't fucking care that the Guggenheim's free on Friday. I am broke. Like the $3 Metro card is difficult for me. And then you want me to be broke and hang out at the Guggenheim? Like, it's not about that, you know? Yeah. So, like, to hear that dichotomy is, like, so
incredible.
Dope. Yeah.
I got to listen to that one.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in streetwear and the hype culture. Mm-hmm. It seems like it maybe is getting out of hand. Do you feel like it's getting out of hand?
Yeah, it is, but it's also got a long way to go, I feel. Yeah. I mean, I think when you say it's getting out of hand, I think you're just hearing about it in so many different facets of business now. Like, there's, like, hype yogurt and, like, hype... I feel like there's going to be hype toilet paper soon, you know?
Yeah. It's Staple just, exclusive.
I'm trying for it, yeah. Charmin, hit me up.
If you start doing toilet paper collabs...
I would totally. I actually have a billion-dollar idea for a toilet paper company.
Okay.
Somebody hit me up. Somebody out there. Talk to me. but yeah, it's just becoming like everywhere you go, there's like got to be a limited edition this, a collaboration with that, you know? And so I think it's just getting a little tiring where like everything is a collaboration, whereas it used to be like very special. And so I think a bubble will burst on like mainstream culture hopping onto that bandwagon, but I think the core of it will always remain true.
Yeah. Do you think there's a downside in the culture? Like, I remember as a kid, I couldn't afford the cool sneakers, and I had kids in my class that had every pair of Jordans when they came out, and it just made me fucking depressed.
Yeah.
And do you feel like the culture right now is doing that to kids, or is it accessible, or is it inaccessible? And
yeah.
How do you feel about that? Like, do you
worry
about that?
It's inaccessible, but you turned out fine, right?
I did.
It's nothing new. Like, wanting something that you can't have is nothing new. You know, we wanted Jordans that were $100. Now kids want a Balenciaga that's $800, you know? It's probably just cost of inflation, to be honest. Like, it's almost matched. Yeah. But there's always going to be something that you don't want. And in fact, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's what drives you. What I am bothered at is now when you see someone head to toe in, like, the quote-unquote right brands or the right releases, and it's just like, they're herbs, you know what I mean? Like, they don't know, like, before, if you wore the right thing, it meant it was currency that you were in on something. Now it just means you have a lot of money. That's
and
really
do you even have a point of view or a personal style if you're just like decked out in off-white?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the other day I was on the subway and this kid was standing next to me and he was wearing head-to-toe Staple. Right, and I was literally standing like right there. And
did you take a selfie with him?
No, I was about to be. I was like, oh no, he's gonna like fan out now. But he had no idea who I was, and it was sort of like
you're in head to toe Staple right next to him, same outfit.
Yeah. No, but I was like, this is an interesting thing because it's like I guess the brand's gotten to a point where like I'm no longer needed as part of the brand, right?
Yeah.
The brand is its own thing now, but also that this kid loves this brand so much, but he also never bothered to be like, who designed it? Like, I don't care. Like, they make fresh clothes.
It's just cool.
Yeah, it's just clothes, you know?
Yeah.
So I felt, you know, I designed that shit. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and then High Sobriety hits you up about ageism and streetwear.
Yeah.
And this is a good segue question from that. Do you feel like you have something to prove? To that
no.
kid.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I'm fine. I'm very content. I'm very happy. Yeah. Life is good.
That's great.
Yeah.
Are you motivated by specific goals these days?
Definitely motivated by the growth of the culture and the next generation. You know, I think the things that I do with like Skillshare classes and talks and stuff and, you know.
Yeah, you're constantly out there.
Yeah, constantly out there just pushing the word on the culture. You know, it's important to me that in the future, streetwear is not a bubble that has bursted, but it was like, you know, it's a flourishing, it's like the next hip hop or like, you know, the next big thing that like spins off all of these jobs and careers and, you know, like cultural icons, in fact, you know. Yeah. And I think it's happening, you know, like you mentioned Virgil and like at LV and stuff, like it's happening, like it's sort of spinning out into the universe. So I want to keep pushing that good word. And a lot of people think it's like a very philanthropic thing for me to do that. Like, oh, it's you're so positive and so nice. And actually, there's a very selfish reason why I do this. Mm-hmm. It's because like if I have a business that exists in this culture, the culture has to
exist. Yeah, for you
right?
to have
I can't
a business that
I can't be the best streetwear brand one of one. Like you're ranked the number one of one streetwear brands. Like that's like it only works if you're ranked like one of 100. So I need 99 other kids to come into the game so that I can stomp on them, right? like come in so that we can battle, and then like,
that's
but I
great.
Need that, yeah. So
well, and
really again,
they keep pushing
that.
You too,
yeah,
right?
And they push me to be better,
yeah,
exactly, yeah.
Is there anybody that's come up that like just made you nervous and you're like, oh shit?
No, not nervous, because like we each do our own thing, like,
yeah.
But I did recently do I did one of these like fashion shows where they have like every brand has like their own section and booth, and you know, this was last year, our 20th anniversary, and this kid next to me has a brand. And I went over into his booth because it was really interesting. And I was like, wow, your brand's really amazing. Like, tell me about your brand. When did you start? He's like, oh, I started on Tuesday. I was like, you started on Tuesday? He's like, yeah, I started on Tuesday, made some tees, long sleeves, built this booth, you know. 3D printed this. I was like, okay. And then like, shit, yeah. He was like, how old's your brand? And I was like, get the fuck out of here, man. Like, I was like, that's when I felt a little, I was like, oh, fuck you.
Damn kids.
Punk ass.
Well, it's also hard when you grew up being like the youngest and being like the one that was like doing hot shit and you were super young and being successful when you're young. And then suddenly you're like not the young guy anymore.
I know.
And I have a huge complex about that now.
Well, I think the other thing that's happening with street culture today is that it's not about building longevity and growth. Like, being Ralph level is not really a thing anymore. Now it's like, build a brand, like flip it for $1 million and then start a new brand the next day. Doesn't matter. You know, it's like slash and burn. And that's cooler now. So like, you know, when it was our 20th anniversary, we were actually quite quiet about it being the 20th because me and my marketing team were like, it might not be that cool to be 2 decades old. Like that's, we're older than our customers. Yeah. Like their lives, like we're selling to a 16-year-old.
Legitimately,
they're gonna be like 20. That's like my dad's age. Like that's like dad gear, you know.
Yeah, you don't want to become the although dad gear is cool now.
Yeah.
So now you're good. Yeah. And the Velcro sneakers are gonna be pretty hot. Right. So
like we didn't. We were gonna have a 20th anniversary like year-end blast, like a big event, and then we decided not to because like of that reason, we didn't want to promote it too much. Right. Yeah.
They're like, oh, it's like Facebook. Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
Or MySpace.
In MySpace. Oh yeah. Do you feel like your ambition ever gets in the way of your happiness?
I can't even separate the two. You know, my work is happiness. Like, I don't know. I'm not a very, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I gave it all to Staple. So it's like, as long as Staple does well and the people around it do well, then I'm really happy. Like, I don't really have like aspirations of a big family and like that white picket fence and like, you know, like that life. I'm pretty all in on Staple. And thankfully I found, you know, I have a wife who's all in on it too. And like, you know, so we don't have kids. Like our kids are like the kids.
Your team.
Yeah, the team and also all the people that like I mentor and stuff. Like, so we get that satisfaction of like parental guidance and all that stuff from that. So it's like, I don't feel like I'm really missing much.
Yeah, that's nice. What's been the most challenging point in your career?
Nothing really. I mean, it's hard, but it's also like, it's hard. Yes, you work a lot, but I feel like, let's say you're an accountant and you hate math, you hate accounting, but like it pays well and you do your 40 hours a week. Like that shit's hard. Like that is hard. Like I get to design sneakers. I have to stay up late and design a Nike. Like, oh, total first world problem. So like, I'm not one to bitch and complain about it. Like, yeah. I get to make pretty pictures, and I think, to be honest, like my wife really checked me on this because she came from like 9 to 5, like grinding it out world, and now she just sees what I do, and she's just like, I can't believe like the life you live, you know. And so it puts things into perspective that like I'm really fortunate. And 5 years into the business, it was really tough, as you probably know. Like there's this 5 year itch that happens, like where I think the statistic is like 90% of businesses fail like in the first 5 years. And so there's something happens after the fifth year where like it just wants to like crush you. Like even if you're doing well, like just the expenses of now more manpower, more rent, everything, like it starts to be like a
stuff levels up and the pressure levels up.
Yeah, exactly. So I really wanted to shut it down after the fifth year. Obviously I didn't, but it was after that point, there wasn't really much, you know, that was that stressful. I think also I was fortunate to have like a couple of near-death experiences right around that time. And so I think that helped.
Like legit near-death?
Yeah, legit, two of them, yeah. Yeah, one was a snowboarding accident or issue that like I was stranded. My friend who's in the room was on the trip with me, but like, yeah, I was missing for like 8 hours. A rescue team was sent.
Where
to
was this?
The Andes Mountains.
Oh yeah, it's not tiny.
No,
yeah,
like 19,000 feet elevation. Like, wow. I was hanging from the edge of a cliff at one point. Like, it was insane. It was insane. Like, I literally, no joke, like buried a grave for myself to just lay in because I was like, I'm done. Yeah,
that's a moment.
Yeah, a prolonged death.
How long were you out there before you were like, well, this might be it?
Yeah, like 7 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it was becoming night. So it was like, if the sun goes below that range and it's pitch black, I'm done.
They're not going to find you.
Yeah, exactly. So I buried like myself and shit, like crazy shit. Like, wow. Literally shit in my pants.
Yeah. Wow. So that'll change like, your... That'll change your perspective on t-shirts.
Yeah. And then another thing happened where I was in Tokyo and I was riding a bike and I got into a head-on collision with a truck on my bicycle. Wow. And I went into the windshield of the truck.
Were you wearing a helmet?
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
So I survived that. And so two very different near-death experiences. One, your life flashes before your eyes when you see like the Mitsubishi logo of a truck like this close to your face. That and then the thinking for 8 hours of your death and like why didn't I do this and like that was like probably the fifth or sixth year of Staple, and going on the snowboard trip, stressing about bills, payroll, rent, like all this shit, and like clients, like this fucking client, right? We've all been there, and then to be like digging your own grave, and to be like, why was I stressing about that client? Like, why was I stressing about bills? You know, and then to come back into the matrix, like. Plug back in, and to just be like, oh wow, this actually all doesn't really matter because anything is better than being on that mountain range in the Andes.
And then how did they end up finding you?
I was so fortunate because somebody on another mountain range, like another total mountain, saw me and was like, dude shouldn't be there. He radioed to this mountain, and then they sent out the team to get me, like right before it became black. And I never knew who that guy was, never found out. I mean, I still keep in touch with the guy who saved me. But yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Was there any like regrets in that moment you were thinking about? Like what were the biggest ones?
That I let work get to me like that. Like stupid. Don't ever let work get to you like that. Like don't ever let parents, your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, your kids, nothing fucking matters. Like just this is another shirt quote from the Business of Hype. Like your job in life is to just stay alive. That's your only job in life. Just stay alive. And if you can do that, like you've already won, you know?
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah.
What's been your...
I suggest near-death experience for everyone in the room.
Funny, guys. This is actually a real escape room. And it's going to be swords and knives, and we're going to just deplete the oxygen.
I would love to start a business where you can like somehow reconstruct a near-death experience. Because like, seriously, these people...
There's no liability there at all. Wait, isn't it... It's skydiving. Skydiving is like a near-death experience. I've never done it, but
if the guy's like, "Oh, the chute doesn't work," like,
push. Just kidding. Yeah.
No, but like people stress out about the dumbest things. Like, just stay alive.
What's been your proudest moment? Staying alive.
No, I don't know. Proudest moment? Ugh, I don't know.
You don't have one.
No.
Okay. You're allowed to not have.
Yeah, I don't really have a.
What do you want to do that you haven't done yet?
I would like to try maybe what it feels like to like not work for a little bit.
Yeah. Do you take vacations?
No. Not really.
When was the last time you took like any time off?
My honeymoon.
Yeah. How long was that?
It was 2 weeks, but I was working throughout. But like, so there. I've never taken like a trip where I'm like, I've never in 21 years taken a trip where the laptop was left at home. You know, or I've never in 21 years written an out-of-office auto reply.
Wow.
Yeah, that says a lot, right?
Yeah, that's. You probably should. Just write it. Write it for a future trip that you might take someday, just to like just get your feet wet and see what it's like.
I just feel like when you come back, like you're just gonna have this mountain of emails that you got to go through now. And it's like I'd rather just like.
The nice thing about the auto reply is it's just a fuck off to everyone, and they're like, "I'm not going to respond to these.
Don't bother.
Email me back in like 2 weeks." But the it's kind of important. How many people do you have working for you now?
Altogether, I mean, I must oversee like 60 people.
Yeah, and you say you delegate now,
uh-huh.
And you hire people you trust.
Uh-huh.
So you could hypothetically leave.
Yeah.
And come back.
That's my. Well, you asked me what my goal is. Yeah. You know, and I'd like to try that.
You like to try that?
Yeah, I'd like to see what that's like.
Yeah, you should do that. And it's also hard too when you travel a lot. So you're seeing amazing things, and,
mm-hmm.
and so you're getting out there.
Exactly. I mean, I've never taken a vacation, but like if I go to London for work, I'll extend for 3 days, go to Amsterdam or something, and then But it's never a full on vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have anyone who makes you jealous?
Jealousy. I am jealous of like. I guess jealous is too hard of a word, but the first person that comes to my mind for some reason is JR, the artist.
Time cover is incredible.
Yeah, that dude. I mean, we're friends, but I just hate him. Like, like everything you do is so fucking dope and profound and next level, and like God, chill out. Can you do something whack, please? Like, can you fuck up? But like, everything he does is like so perfectly executed.
And big. It's all really
like,
big.
It's yeah. big, game-changing, people moving. Like, you know, it's just everything. Creative, right? Yeah. And like, yeah.
It sounds like you should do a collaboration.
I would like to, but I'm happy just being his friend.
Just being a fan.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool. Do you have a nemesis?
I have frenemies. Yes, okay. There's frenemies in this industry.
Yeah,
for sure. I think
people you're competitive with.
Yeah, it's probably the same in any, you know, if you're a graphic designer or ad agency or something, like, you have the competitive agencies. If you're in the same room, you'll say hi. You say your conversations, but you secretly want them to fail really bad. Yeah. So wow. I have those.
Uh huh. It keeps you going. It keeps you motivated.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. What is success to you?
Success to me is waking up every day and, you know, staying alive, point number one. And then point number two, not dreading what you're about to do. You know, it's pretty simple. I remember prior to Staple, I've had a ton of like jobs, not careers, but like shitty jobs. Like I said, working at Paragon and, you know, sweeping floor at a hair salon and delivering pizzas, fucking rewinding tapes at a video store. That's how old I am.
It's a real job. It was a real job, guys.
Yeah. So like, I remember what it feels like to wake up and like just wish that like you could just the alarm just throw it away. You know what I mean? And I also remember what it feels like vividly to like look at the clock and it's like, oh, it's 3 o'clock. I have 2 hours left, right? And then like you do some work and then you look at the clock again. It's like only 20 minutes have passed and you're like, what the fuck, right? Yeah. And now it's like I'm living in an alternate universe. Where even though most of my friends do live that life, like my life is like I wake up and it's like I just hop right out of bed and literally open the laptop and I'm like before I even brush my teeth, sometimes I'm working in the morning. And similarly, like when it comes to time management, it's like I'm like, all right, it's 2 a.m. I'll just work another 30 minutes and then I'll stop. And then like I look out the window and the sun is up like this. And I'm like, what the fuck happened to time? Like it's so flipped from like when you hate your life.
You know? Yeah, it goes so fast.
Yeah. So like my definition of success is like try to get yourself to that side of the matrix, you know, like because the other side is total BS. Yeah. And it's really quite easy. Like I think people have a hard time with like, what am I supposed to do in life? What's my passion? What's my calling? Right. And everyone has something that they can't or don't want to stop doing. Right. Whether it's like it could be drinking. I don't know. Like whatever you want to do that like you just that you can't stop doing, like just figure out how to make money from that. Even if it's $5, like just figure out that like I can monetize off of this somehow. And like, I'll give you a great example, like video games.
Oh my God.
Right?
Like multi-billion dollar industry
and
now.
And like kids get a starting contract for E-Game League is $60,000 to play video games, right? And it's just, you wouldn't think that anything else, like how do you get paid doing that? But like these kids just figured out a way.
I have friends that are getting paid to like $1,000 to write weed reviews for a website, reviewing weed and how it feels at different points, and they make like $500,000 per weed that they review.
So that to me, that's a definition of happiness.
Yeah,
you know, I'd rather make. He's like, can I get an application? No, but no. If you're in like that guy would rather make how much?
It's like $1,000 in a review.
Yeah,
something,
like
or
so he'd rather do that than probably make like. You know, six figures doing some other bullshit job, you know? Yeah.
That they don't enjoy, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you happy?
So happy.
Yeah.
So, good. So happy.
I can tell. Yeah.
Yeah. Like a doctor could literally tell me right now, you have 6 hours to live, Jeff. And I'd be like, yeah, good. I'm fine. Totally fine. I've stolen lives. Like, I feel like I've seen so many amazing things that, like, I've robbed children of, like, lives or something. Like, I feel like some weird... Like human, like it's unfair. Like, I deserve to die. Like, seriously. Like, no, I'm serious. Like, if that was like you have a day to live, I'd be like, yeah, I deserve this. Like, I've seen too many good things. I've eaten too many good foods. I've met too many amazing people. Someone else must get this now.
Tap out.
Yeah, exactly. I'm tapping out.
That's incredible. Well, Jeff, thank you for doing this. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks, guys.
It's a great ending. We have a few minutes for questions. If anyone wants to questions before we get back to hitting the bar, I'll give you the mic.
So it's on the podcast.
All right. Thank you for the talk. It was awesome.
Thanks.
You guys both talked about technology and about Instagram and what kind of effect that has to people. But also, some of the tools that technology is giving people, like graphic designers or anyone who wants to start their brands now, it's like you said, the guy started his brand in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. So what kind of advice do you have for people in that situation right now? Because we can take advantage of so many tools, but there is this sort of like pressure of like, you know,
yeah,
the social proof or whatever.
Exactly. I mean, so, yeah. I guess it's a little hard for me to answer this because I remember a time where there was no social media. So it's easy for me to be like, do it the way it was done back then. But if you grew up on the internet, there is no previous, right?
You can't unprogram yourself from that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I will say what I think the advice should be, but it might be easier said than done, which is like, use social media as a tool. And when I say that, it's like, I used to print flyers at Kinko's, and the choices were like full color or black and white, right? And then when they did like spot varnish, it was like, whoa, like new technology, right?
Yeah.
And so like, and then came, you know, like blogging, and then tweeting, and then Facebook, and then, you know, like Instagram, and then Snapchat. Like
these amplification methods.
That's
yeah.
all it is. That's a great example. It is Instagram and social media is only a different sized speaker. But if the speaker isn't plugged into anything of substance, it's just useless. So concentrate on the actual output device. Like, what are you saying? Then you can plug in whatever thing that, you know, you've had. I mean, like I said before, like my home landline was on my first business card, and now we have Instagram. If I didn't have my story, my solid vision and story baked like 21 years ago, I'd be scrambling with every advent, you know? And I have a lot of friends that make really good money on Instagram, but they only make it on Instagram, and they have to do the hashtag ad, hashtag sponsored, and like I could teeth whitener and like coffee scrub, and like every day it's like, they're
yeah,
like,
and what's gonna happen to them
when
Instagram goes
Mark Zuckerberg
away? Yeah.
Just like, oh, I'm shutting down Instagram, or like, you know, we're selling to like
something
10 cents.
New comes around, you have to start over again.
Exactly, yeah. So it's scary. Like, I always tell my friends who are really killing on IG right now, I'm like, yo, diversify. Make merch. Get off IG somehow so that you can make money some other way, you know?
It's definitely putting all your eggs in one basket. And
a scary-ass basket.
Yeah.
You remember when they changed
the algorithm
from, like, chronological scroll? Like, people lost their homes. They're like, oh, my God, I can't afford rent this month because they changed the algorithm.
Yeah. Cool. I have a friend who had, like, 75,000 followers, and he's like, I used to post stuff, and I would get 2,000 likes, 3,000 likes. He's like, I get 100.
Yeah.
And he's like, and this is my living. It's my well-being.
Yeah. Yep. Or when they cleaned up the robot followers things, and it's like, you went from 75 to like 50, like all of a sudden.
And then if you're doing sponsored content, you have to charge differently now, and you're not making as much and all that shit.
Yeah. So diversify the way you sort of, you know, make your living.
Yeah.
So I've been in New York for about 7 months, and I'm
Nice. Where are you from?
Minneapolis.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's very cold. But basically, I'm finally getting to the point where I'm actually making it in graphic design, and I've got,
amazing,
like, the job that pays a shit ton, the job that I'm passionate about, the job that I'm really passionate about that I do overnight.
Okay,
and
yeah.
I'm basically,
so you have the dual thing. You have a job, and then you have your night thing,
three,
your passion.
Three right now. So
what's the third one?
Well, it's just, like, I've got different clients, but one's full-time, and it's, like, the money one. Then I've got the other ones that are more like passion. I'm trying to more focus on that.
Yeah.
So what's your recommendation for like when you get to the point of burnout? Do you hit that point ever? Do you have any ideas on?
No.
You don't?
No, I don't have burnout. But you burnout, when you say burnout, you mean sick of clients or run out of ideas type burnout?
Exhaustion.
Exhaustion.
Yeah.
I would say exhaustion comes from you doing probably a little bit of too much stuff that you don't want to be doing. Mm-hmm. You don't get exhaustion from doing everything you want to be doing, right? So, I swear by that. Like, if you love what you do, you will never get tired of doing it until, like, it's just, you know, you have to sleep because of your biological makeup. But other than that, you just want to keep doing it. Yeah. So you're probably getting burnt out. And I have felt that because even though, you know, we've reached a level of success, I'm trying to say this friendly for the podcast, but there are projects that we do where we do it for the check, right? And like, we, not every project is like happy-go-lucky joy and we would do this for free. No, like, there's jobs that we do because this job is going to help keep the lights on for like 2 years if we just, you know, and it's very whorish, but like, we do it, you know? And it sounds like, just from how you described it briefly, like maybe more than 50% of your life is that.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's where the exhaustion comes from. So I would say the advice is obviously mitigate that down to below 50% while slowly nudging your passion projects up a little bit. And it's not going to be overnight. I spent, when I was young and I just started Staple, that time where I was like selling the t-shirts and stuff. So I was full-time student at Parsons. I worked as a design assistant at this design studio in Soho called Site Design. It's still there on Wooster Street. And then at night, I worked at like a fake Kinko's, you know, like a 24-hour copy shop. And I did that job, the graveyard shift, like midnight to 3 a.m. And I mostly did it so that I could print out my own catalogs, right? Yeah, but you know, it was a paying job. And then I did Staple, right? And so I was sort of juggling all of these things like you are. And I did that for 9 months of like full-time school, right after that Site Design, right after that Kinko's. Then go home at like 3 a.m. and try to ink out some Staple stuff, which I was able to do. It's, you're nodding your head like this is familiar. Yeah, and then it was like I finally was able to start peeling away at some of those things and like rolling on Staple. But even at that point, it was a massive gamble on Staple. It was a massive gamble. Like, I knew I only had a short amount of time to roll the dice. So maybe, I hear a lot of friends do this too. Like, store your acorns like a squirrel would, like, in the job that you don't like, so that the more you store, the more runway you have to do your passion project. Store enough so you're like, all right, I've got 18 months where if I don't make a penny at my passion project, I'm good. But give yourself that year and a half to, like, try it.
Hey, Jeff. Hi. Thanks. I guess I wanted to talk about a little bit of your experience. You touched on how you came from an Asian American family, and I can relate to that because my parents are immigrants as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, when they first came to the country, they wanted you know, for me and my younger brother to have a better life. And you know, sort of building on that, and you know, maybe you can relate to this, but Asian American parents, especially immigrant parents, don't really understand the creative aspect of things. And right now, what I'm doing with my career has nothing really to do with what I studied in college. Like, I did economics and accounting.
Yeah.
And like, now I'm here doing like digital marketing and creative stuff in New York. Mm-hmm. And this is my first job out of college. And my parents are like,
You're wasting your life.
Yeah. Why didn't you just get a government job in like DC or work corporate? Why did you like move all the way to New York? And they still like 100% don't support it, but like they want me to be happy. But like, I guess like, where do you find that balance mm-hmm. in like trying to find success and like pursuing your passions versus like leaving behind 4 years of college that you like paid for and studied yeah. your ass off for?
Right. So I can answer this even above and beyond like the Asian American thing or the race thing. I think that this applies to all people where like at some point in your life, there's going to be somebody, whether it's your parents or your loved ones, or it could be if you have kids, like the responsibility that's beholden on you from your children to like try to force you to like make these decisions, right? And my advice, unfortunately, is that you have to be like an asshole and you have to be selfish. And it's true, like, sure, you can. I think you should go through a time where, like, you try to convince the people you love and care for that this makes me happy. I'm really going to try to pursue this. I hope you can be supportive of me. But I'll tell you, from my life, like, I didn't talk to my dad for 10 years. Like, I had a falling out with my dad for a decade, which is half the lifespan of my company. And then it wasn't until I appeared in a Chinese newspaper, a quarter page feature in a Chinese newspaper, that I got a call from my dad a decade later. And he's like, oh, hey, can you imagine? I didn't talk to my dad for 10 years. Hey, it looks like things are going well. I'm like, bro, where the fuck were you? Now that I got like a feature in a Chinese newspaper, I'm all of a sudden a success to you, you know? And so now, you know, me and my dad are okay, but like we're just cordial. We talk like once a year, you know? So, but that's, you asked about sacrifices. Like, I sacrificed my dad. Like, I cut him off so that I could pursue Staple. If he was always in my life nagging and questioning and like, I wouldn't have Staple, but like, I don't know which is better. Maybe maybe if I had a great relationship with my dad, things would be different. But yeah, that sacrifice is really big. And I've always lived by this rule. And I don't know if it's right for everyone necessarily, but my rule is that if you can't make yourself happy, it is mathematically and scientifically impossible for you to make other people happy. I think if you have sadness and angst within you, you cannot make your wife, husband, parent, kids happy. I think it's actually impossible. Like, think about that. How could that be possible? If you don't know what happiness is, how are you going to impose happiness on others? you have to take care of yourself first, you know? And then now, like, I think my dad's happy for me. We don't have a great relationship, but I think he's happy for me. My mom also hated everything I did, but now she can't go on an airplane without bragging about me. It's so annoying, you know? So, like, it took a long time. It took 10, 20, maybe 15 years for my mom to come around, but, like, now she's super happy, you know? And I'm happy, so that's a win-win. But if you go through life just trying to please everyone, like, it's ripe for failure. And that goes for any race, any age, you know?
Well, yeah. I think also other people's feelings are beyond your control. So there's nothing you can do. You can't control that, so you just got to let it go.
If you went and worked, got that job in D.C., they'd be like, what, that branch of the government? Like, no, I meant this other branch. Like, really, I just gave up everything and went to D.C., but it wasn't the right branch. Or, like, you know, like, you're always going to be trying to make them happy. Like, and I don't want to tell people, like, life lessons on how to deal with their parents. I'm just telling you how I did it. Yeah, it was a big sacrifice.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Yeah,
it's
thank
been really
you, guys.
Great.
Jeff, thanks so much for joining me. I'm looking forward to rocking those limited edition Velcro pigeon sneakers this time next year. If you enjoyed this overshare, please let us know. We would love to hear from you. You can send us a message on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook at Overshare Talks. Also, subscribe to ensure you get our future episodes when they're released, and rate and review us to help other people discover Overshare. Thanks to Lucky Jacks on Orchard Street in New York City for hosting us. Thanks to our audio engineer, Jared Nangle, to Working Not Working's Gabby D'Amato for editing this episode, and the Overshare theme song is Let It Grow by Caleb Grow. And if you'd like to learn more about Working Not Working, join us as a creative or to hire incredible creatives, check us out at workingnotworking.com. That's all we've got for season two, and if you haven't listened to all the episodes, I encourage you to dive back into the archives. There's a lot of wisdom and oversharing in the other 21 episodes that I know you enjoy. So check those out, and we'll see you for season three.